is Rhode Island's longest running financial talk show, Money Talk with Don Soa. Taking care of business and working overtime. With market insights and so much more, talk to Don now at 437-5000 or 1-888-345-0790. This is Money Talk with Don Soa.
Yeah, we welcome you to the Money Talk program, everybody. I am Don Soa. It is, we're right smack in the middle of the month of April, starting out the second quarter, as some of you may notice if you listen to financial news, that we've also just started what we refer to as earnings season. The S&P 500, the 500 largest companies that trade publicly in the U.S., make up that index, and they pretty much announce their earnings, or at least the financial media presents their earnings information in alphabetical order. So it's the AA is the symbol, you know, is basically Alcoa, AA, when you look at the spelling of it. And then they go on through the week. So we're starting to get more. We've had a few already announced this week. By the end of the week, we will have had the first 20%. So 100 of the 500 companies will have announced. But surprisingly enough, it's been information related to some of the big ones, financials. There's a company out there named Goldman Sachs that shocked Wall Street, actually, by missing estimates. I'm not sure that they've actually ever done that. I think that's the big issue. I think they literally, they reported weaker than expected first quarter results across the board. Trading revenue disappointed analysts. And I think a lot of traders on Wall Street and a lot of the analysts were just shocked that they came in that way, because somebody was saying they looked back at the history of the company and they can't remember the last time they actually missed analyst estimates. And, you know, the markets assign a price to the stock of the company based upon their expectations of, well, how much will the company earn? And that's the top line number. Mm-hmm. And then after they look at the way they manage their money, which is very highly efficient among so many companies, then they look at the bottom line number. What's their net profit? So they miss on top line and bottom line numbers, and people are a little bit shocked. And the end result is the Dow dropped triple digits today, finished off of its lows, but it did go down 113 points today after a massively big day yesterday where we were up about 180 or more. S&P was down 0.29 and the NASDAQ was down 0.12. Uniquely, it was only the Russell 2000, the small cap stocks, that actually finished in the green.
You know, it's funny. I remember a time not so long ago, probably 8 years ago or so, when if there was a day where we saw a triple digit swing in one direction or the other, that would be a catalyst for phone calls, especially if it was a drop. People would call if we saw over 100-point drop on the Dow and say, you know, what's going on? Do I need to be concerned? I just want to talk to you about my money. And that really doesn't happen anymore, because we've become accustomed to volatility in this manner. We've been accustomed to larger swings. And also, you know, if we're talking 8 years ago, the Dow was significantly lower than it is now. So a triple point swing was a much higher percentage move. So it's I just always find it interesting that the same type of event that would, you know, drive behavior before really doesn't have the same effect at all anymore.
Well, I think one of the things that caught analysts and traders, investors off guard was that the first quarter of this year was very strong.
Stronger than we always say, you know, the first quarter we do typically see, you know, good numbers, but this was very different.
The broad market was up on average about 5%, and that's and when you have a company that's so heavy into the investment banking category, which deals with a lot of money management and investing, you should have said, well, obviously they're going to do well in that one sector of their business. And last quarter marked the first time, apparently, since 2015. That Goldman's earnings per share missed analysts' expectations for the first time since the first quarter of last year that sales actually came in below estimates. I mean, you got to remember, 2015 was the year in which the actual stock market dropped.
In the month of October,
it was down. It had a correction of 13.3%. It did recover during the quarter, but did still finish down nearly 4% for the year.
I think people tend to forget, because it was in the middle of a bull market run. You know, it was in the middle of, an eight-year bull market. So that little blip in there, people forget about it.
Well, you know, there are analysts out there. They're either going to be upside or downside analysts. There's, you know, they call them the you know, the bulls or the bears, whatever they want to call it. I mean, some there are people out there who are analysts today that I'll read their articles, I'll read their statements, but they're guys who are perennial bears. I mean, they're always bearish.
Eventually, they're going to be right.
Well, that's right? The whole point. It's like a broken clock is right twice a day.
Yeah.
I mean, so they're going to fall into that category. But I'm usually looking for people who are much more realistic about things. And yes, on occasion, they'll come in with a bit of a negative perspective. But a lot, there are analysts who feel that, okay, there's... The common term being used is not the term correction. The common term is a pullback.
Pullback, we're hearing, which is different.
More and more of the people who are commentators on this issue will say, we're looking for maybe a 3 or 4 or 3 to 5% pullback somewhere in here, but that would be ideal because that'll be that buying opportunity that an investor would have. I mean, if suddenly you could buy Facebook or you could buy Apple or Google or any of these at a 5% off.
A bit of a discount.
On a 5% off sale. Then you'll say, well, okay, well, I missed the first move that they made this year earlier on. Now all of a sudden, maybe I get another shot at it. So that's the nature of it. But Treasury's prices actually went up, sending the benchmark 10-year note yield down to 2.22. Now, here is a yield on the 10-year that was up almost at 2.5 at one point as part of this recent cycle. So when you see the yields dropping, that means the value of the bond is rising. It's a little unusual when you're in an environment where all they're talking about is the Federal Reserve raising interest rates on the Fed fund rate. So, but this is today is official because of yesterday's race up in the Boston area. They it's a holiday in Massachusetts, and the primary IRS headquarters for processing of returns is in, was it Andover, I suppose, up there? It's in Andover up in Massachusetts. So they close the door, so they give the day off, and they give everybody till the following day, today.
Yes,
to
Patriots Day bought you one more day.
So I know that you are always looking at some of the
fun trends that occur
as a result
over
of the
last
this.
Few years are freebies on tax day, which is
freebies?
Always a fun thing. So, and it's mostly you know, like chain retailers or restaurants that will have some sort of freebie, and of course it's something small that's meant to kind of get you in the door to spend money elsewhere. But if you are looking for something for free, a couple of places that may now. Just because the chain doesn't mean they do it in your local location, so you have to check. But some of the ones that I was able to find are Boston Market. They are selling half chicken meal with two sides, cornbread, and a fountain drink for $10.40. And where do you think that comes from? Form 1040. You file your taxes.
Yeah. Yep.
So you get a discount there. JetBlue has a big raffle going. If you owe money to the IRS, you can enter JetBlue's tax return drawing. They're giving away 1,000 one-way flights. They have a website for it called JetBlueTaxReturnFlight.com. At Office Depot, you can get shredding. If you want to get rid of your old documents, Office Depot is offering 5 pounds of free shredding through the end of the month. Through April 29th. In some McDonald's, not all of them, but some McDonald's are selling a Big Mac or a quarter pounder for a penny if you buy one at the regular price. So you got to check for that one. P.F. Chang's is offering 20% off their takeout orders with the promo code TAXDAY through April 18th. So there's a local P.F. Chang's around here at the Province Place Mall. So if you have a takeout order there, use your promo code TAXDAY. And Sonic Burger, we have a Sonic in is it Smithfield?
On 44.
Yeah. You knew that right away. We have one
I
there.
Shouldn't.
Well, the Cello's is near there, so you drive
Cello's,
by
I
on
drive
your
right
way
by
to Cello's.
I go to Cello's right down the street.
Yeah.
Or Siena.
So they have, I don't know if this one has it, but their cheeseburgers are half price today. And then there are some other ones, too. Those are the quickest ones.
Now, didn't JetBlue say that if you do get the free the place, you have to sit in seat number W2?
W2. You're so funny.
I can't. I'm a
nerd humor. That's what that is.
Well, needless to say, aside from a lot of what would move the markets related to earnings numbers, and we'll see how that shakes out, we're finding for the last several earnings seasons that the market has the largest percentage, a very large percentage of the S&P 500 have either met or beat analyst estimates. So we can't be too disappointed, although they arguably say that the bar has been set a little bit lower so that maybe it's easier for them to reach those numbers. A lot of investors are looking overseas, though. They're looking at the international markets. They're keeping an eye on France. The campaigning ramped up ahead of the first round of their presidential elections, and left-wing candidate Jean-Luc Mélenchon, he's surging in the polls, that apparently added to some investors' worries as it becomes sort of unclear who will actually win the contest. The person who was thought to be the main head runner was Marine Le Pen. She's still certainly the real problem, but she actually believes in fundamentally altering the state of the euro. She's not a big supporter of the eurozone, so she's sort of her version of a pro-Brexit type of individual. But Mélenchon, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, he is sort of the socialist communist disaster for French economy. But, you know, what else is new, I guess? He's just a little bit more economically extreme than Hollande, who is who has been the present president there. European equities fell broadly as UK Prime Minister Theresa May called for a snap election in the month of June. The announcement also sent the British pound for a loop. The currency rose about 1%. No one was expecting that particular announcement, not least of all because the government itself ruled an election before 2020 out barely 4 weeks ago. They ruled it out, the idea of another set of elections for members of parliament. But Theresa May has clearly decided she smells an opportunity to consolidate her mandate ahead of the Brexit negotiations, which are coming up, according to a number of different analysts. So, yeah, so stuff happening in the U.S., stuff happening overseas, stuff happening with earnings. Everything is creating uncertainty and volatility. And so we should expect more bumpy rides, good days, really good days, and bad days, some pretty lousy ones, too, potentially. But we'll be keeping you in mind as to what trends are starting to emerge. We're going to take a quick break here on the Get Back to Basics Tuesday program with Donna Soa Allard and myself. I'm Don Soa. We'll be right back.
It's time for Dunkin' Donuts Regional Traffic, brought to you by Dunkin' Donuts. Dunkin' Donuts Iced Coffee is America's iced coffee, now available in new butter pecan and coconut cream pie flavors. America runs on Dunkin'. Price and participation may vary, limited time offer.
195 East and West, pretty busy right now going through the bridges. A little bit of heavy volume there for you on the westbound side from about Pawtucket Avenue. On the eastbound side, across the bridge as you go, it's slow there. 95 northbound, still busy as you move on up into town, but you're moving okay. Coming down the southbound side, a little bit sluggish as you go by Smithfield Ave. Stays that way all the way through downtown, especially if you're trying to get off onto 195 east. 6 inbound heavy into 95. 295 northbound, still busy between 37 and Plainfield Pike. I'm Rich Teeter with your right now traffic.
Sponsored by the Detox and Treatment Helpline.
The Waite Institute for Violence Prevention, the Ad Council, and this station.
This is Money Talk with Don Soa, exclusively on AM 790 Talk and Business.
And we're back with the Money Talk program. Now, I know a great many of you get a lot of financial news and information, whether it's online, of course, or on the radio, certainly listening to programs like Money Talk, and on television. It seems to me that there's always cycles where you see large numbers of marketing programs, commercials of various types. There was a time when investment firms of one type or another were out there seemingly at war with each other, battling over whose investments, whose mutual funds, whose assets, whose managers were the best performing mutual funds within those markets. Yet I have not heard in a couple of years, quite frankly, I have not heard any type of public marketing that actually talks about
focus on performance.
Performance. Our managers are the better performers. I mean, that doesn't seem to be in focus for them, but they are certainly out there talking.
They certainly are.
And so what the big issue is, all the commercials that are out there, it seems like they're trying to underprice each other.
There's, you know, in talking about advertising based on performance, the recognition that there's, you know, such a generally high level of efficiency in markets makes it very difficult for you to sell based solely on performance. There are so many mutual funds. There are so many fund families, and they all employ very smart people with, you know, strategies for investing in one area or another. And in the ones where most people are investing, like your core positions of, you know, large cap, medium cap, small cap stocks, some international, a little bit of real estate. You know, these are areas where there is, you know, generally efficiency and a good deal of transparency. So they have to find some other way to differentiate themselves and sell themselves to consumers.
But before we get into what I think is the essence of cost differentiation that we should know about and talk about, a lot of the commercials you do see on TV, well, you see the guy in his office looking out the window. He's at the corner office. He's looking at the big skyscraper next door. And all of a sudden, you've got this competitive company, and there's a big banner being rolled off on the side of the building, which says, trades $4.95 a trade, or that's not what we're really talking about. When you see that kind of thing where they're competing, well, this company does $6.95 trades, this one does $4.95 trades. What kind of cost debate is that?
That's a fee.
It's the trade.
You're talking about trading costs.
Yeah, trading costs.
Yeah, that's a transaction fee.
So
it doesn't matter who's doing it or what area of investment it is. It's a transaction fee for whatever type of trade you're doing.
And that would be whether you're buying the shares of a mutual fund or whether you're buying the shares of an individual stock.
Right.
And in other words,
I'm sorry, your question seemed fancier than that, Dad. Sorry.
Yeah, it wasn't very fancy. I was trying to make the distinction between what I call traditional expenses, or fees, or commissions that people think about.
Yeah.
Which could be anywhere from the old days when they would.
That's what you're talking about is a transaction fee is something that you see every time it's done, right? You get a confirmation statement that says transaction fee or trading fee, confirmation fee, you see it there. It's very transparent, right? It's not hidden. It's not wrapped up into anything. You see the fee for what it is.
Now.
And you control it, time you trade.
When the online electronic trading outfits out there, the E-Trades, the TD Ameritrade, a lot of these, when they started developing, some of the more mainline companies like Schwab and others, they all got into a business where they were competing for the business of the investor who was not really an investor. He was actually a trader, a person who they even used to call them day traders.
And these are people who are doing a lot of transactions, placing a lot of trades. So trading costs really do matter.
So, I mean, if you do 50 or 60 trades based upon the model that you're using, and when I say trades, I mean buys or sells involve a fee or a transaction fee. And let's just say for simple math that the fee is $5, but you do 100 of them, buys or sells in a given day, well, you just spent $500. That's part of your cost.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so you got to factor that in when you actually figure out whether you made any money or not as part of that trade. And these are individuals who are jumping in or jumping out of a ownership position, literally sometimes hours. I've seen cases where people bought the stock at 10 o'clock in the morning and sold it by 3 in the afternoon.
Right. You're looking for short-term gains there or grabbing losses or whatever it happens to be. That's very different than a typical investor.
But now, the only reason we mention this as part of this discussion is because it is a cost factor that investors have to deal with. If you are doing that, and yes, you in fact, let's just say you're lucky enough to catch the spread. So you made $1.50 on the trade during the course of the day, but you traded enough shares that you made yourself $200 or $300. Well, that's nice if you did, but first of all, you got to factor in the cost of the trading, which may be more than the $300 or $400 you made. But number two is that these are going to be calculated for tax purposes at some point as short-term capital gains. And short-term capital gains are going to be taxed as ordinary income.
Yep, so that's a higher rate than your more desirable long-term, which are going to be, depending on your income bracket, either at 0, 15, 20%.
Now, there's a phrase out there. Actually, we're reading an article in one of the magazines, industry magazines, and it was the article was called The Discount Firm Price Wars. And in this case, they're not actually talking about those trading costs, like you said, that are the obvious ones. But there are expenses inside these portfolios in other words, the management and operation of the fund or the ETF or the index. And that sort of thing is something you've got to be aware of because it is a cost factor.
Yeah, and it's something that over the course of 2016 and now 2017, we're seeing this as really being the focus of the larger fund families and firms is these internal expenses on your core positions. And the focus of it is on exchange traded funds. So mutual fund companies will often have a line of exchange traded funds, which are both similar and different from mutual funds.
Now, so you get to understand the differential, to understand this issue of efficiency versus less efficient markets, you've got to also deal with another debate that's out there, and that's the difference between active investing and passive investing. Mm-hmm. So,
right. And so typically when you hear active investing, you're talking about an actively managed mutual fund. And so if you think about it, and passive, you're typically talking about a passively managed exchange traded fund. These are both pooled investments where you're getting diversification through one trade, right? So if I buy a large cap stock ETF or if I buy a large cap stock mutual fund, I just have to place one buy and I get diversification in this area by owning multiple securities, right? I owe fractional shares of multiple securities in the fund.
The best known of these for debate and argument is the S&P 500
sure.
index.
Most of you probably own one in your 401k at work or in your other portfolio. And what it means is what you own through that one trade is a fund that looks to generally mirror the S&P 500 index.
Okay, this is really what we're talking about, is what's happening within these companies and why it should matter and whether you should care about it, and which funds will not be really participating in this type of cost structure issue. And you should be aware of that, too, because there are areas that are more costly than others. And it may affect, and we'll explain how it can affect you as a long-term investor in terms of the goals that you have. I'm Don Sowa with Donna Sowa Allard, and this is the Get Back to Basics program, Money Talk on AM 790. We'll be right back.
AM 790 Talk and Business.
I'm Nick Sowa.
AM 790 Talk and Business.
And we're back with the Get Back to Basics program. I'm Don Sowa with my daughter, Donna Sowa Allard, my partner here in studio, offering you some ideas about the types of investments, the vehicles that a great many of us have available to us today. It's almost like a universe of choices where when I started in the profession like 35 years ago, it could be counted in the hundreds, the different number of funds there were, and now it's tens of thousands of them.
Well, now if you think about it, you go into Morningstar and you plug in screens for whatever you're looking for among the mutual fund universe or the ETF universe, and it's pages upon pages upon pages of options.
Well, yeah. You know, it's that diversity that makes for wonderful opportunity for investors, but it's that same amount of sheer exposure to investing. The amount of information that's out there can be a little bit overwhelming. So for purposes of our discussion today, let's talk, before we just start getting into the issue of costs, let's talk about the real differences between a actively managed mutual fund and, say, an index fund or an ETF.
Sure. If we very quickly kind of go through, your basic similarities are, and I mentioned before we went to the break, the idea of diversification. You get a diversified collection of stocks or bonds or whatever the securities are you're purchasing. And that could potentially help reduce risk, right? We say don't put all your eggs in one basket. So you're not looking to just pick the best large cap company. You're buying a group of large cap companies, right? So you have that, and it's cost efficient in that you don't have to place multiple trades. You can just buy it in one fund, whether it be an ETF or an actively managed mutual fund. You do get professional management. Even in a passively managed ETF, there is still a team that manages the way the filters are run. And there is still a team, even though it's not the same type of active management as in a mutual fund.
There's also computer programmers.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's generally being run through computerized filters and screens. The risk of whatever fund you're purchasing is going to be derived from the risk of the underlying holdings, right? So the risk isn't the fund itself. It's the risk of all of the securities that it owns.
But if a large cap like an S&P 500 fund,
yeah.
The funds are going to be dictated, the holdings within the fund, the 500 companies that are part of that index.
It's dictated by the S&P.
Will be dictated yeah. by that index. The index is provided. So any fund family, whether it's Schwab or Fidelity or Putnam or Vanguard, that are going to offer an S&P 500 fund, first of all, there's going to be very, very little difference one company to another. Their S&P 500 fund should produce approximately what the 500, what the ownership, the market-weighted ownership of those 500 companies.
Because it's looking to mirror that index proportionally. And so that kind of brings you to the idea of performance. An S&P 500 index fund, exchange-traded fund, is not looking to beat the performance of the S&P 500. It's looking to generally match it. It's looking to come close to generally match the performance of the index, whether it be the S&P 500 or the Russell 2000 or the Barclays Ag. It's looking to generally match it. But if you have an actively managed mutual fund, they're looking to add alpha. And alpha means that little something extra, the added performance. It's saying, why are we paying for active management? Because we are expecting to get something more. And there are some environments where your actively managed mutual fund may be more likely to provide that alpha than there are other environments where it probably won't.
Well, even the founder of Vanguard, and Vanguard ultimately is the pioneering company of the world of indexing, mm-hmm. especially they're the first ones who came out and made an S&P 500 fund available to the public. But even they said, well, okay, so you're going to own all 500 of the largest companies that trade in the market in the U.S. But we decided that there are going to be occasions, and certainly certain investors, who don't want to own all 500 of those companies. They may be 500 big companies, but they're all not necessarily going to be performing well in the current economic environment. So we do, in fact, have a management team. We do, in fact, have some managers. There was a gentleman named John Neff, who may be one of their longest-serving managers at Vanguard. And he decided he would pick, based upon a series of models and some research that he did, perhaps maybe 160 or 70 of the 500 based upon certain criteria. Maybe the size of the dividend being paid. Maybe the funds that have not only dividend payments but increasing dividend payments consistently over a period of time. There's a whole series of things that may fall into that category. And so what they did was they created a fund called the Vanguard Windsor Fund. Again, the benchmark that it would be compared to would be its own S&P 500 index benchmark. But now, how often that fund outperformed the index over time? It didn't outperform it every year.
I'm just going to say it doesn't.
Their goal yeah. would be to do so. But they did find that he probably matched or underperformed the index 70% of the time. So 30% of the time he might have had, and maybe through luck, who knows, but he may have had an opportunity to beat the index, because all you need perhaps is five or six of those large companies that are market cap weighted. Five or six of them suddenly could have a spectacular year and hit the ball out of the park. Mm-hmm. And he may be a little bit overweighted in those particular companies, whereby the index would have a limited structured weighting within its overall portfolio of 500 companies. So the active manager will, on occasion, especially during periods of economic or market volatility, that's when the active manager may have the opportunity to outperform the index that it's matched to.
You know, we often hear the phrase, they've already picked the low-hanging fruit. And what that means is when you're in a prolonged bull market, like we have been for quite some time, you know, companies are doing well. Most funds are generally doing well. Active managers now have an opportunity to, or now have an obligation to look for opportunities. The low-hanging fruit's already been picked. We've already seen performance from those companies. So what is maybe not as transparent, or what is a little, where is there a hidden opportunity based on value or whatever? Where can we add alpha by identifying those areas?
Well, may be managers right now who are looking at the economic environment that is potentially evolving in this political year. If, in fact, the White House, with support of elements of Congress, are able to pass certain tax reform programs, then, for example, programs that will tax at a much lower rate than 35%, money coming mm-hmm. from overseas, money being held by corporations because it's being taxed overseas where it's originating, but once it comes back into the U.S. market, it's going to be taxed a second time at a very high rate. Well, there may be a mutual fund active manager who's going to say, let's identify all of the companies that are holding on their balance sheets more than a certain percentage of their market value in cash. And a great example would be an Apple you know, AAPL, they've got $250 billion of their market cap, of their value, is in cash right now. There's a whole bunch of other ones, IBM, a lot of companies that do business overseas, and based upon their overseas profits, they're paying taxes there, but they're avoiding or reluctantly not bringing the money back into the United States, keeping the money for outside European or Asian activities because they can avoid paying the taxes. Well, that means the U.S. tax system, our Treasury Department, doesn't benefit from that. And, of course, the government can't use those profits that they would make for infrastructure spending or other things that the president would like to do.
Another difference between your mutual funds and your exchange-traded funds is the way you buy and sell them and the way that they're priced. So ETFs trade like stocks, so they have intraday prices and you can buy throughout the day. With mutual funds, they're purchased at NAV, which is net asset value, and that's only priced at the end of the day. So that is a difference. You get to 4 o'clock with your mutual funds and whatever that's the price. But with your exchange traded funds, there's intraday pricing.
We've seen occasions like back in 1987, it was October. It was Black Friday and Black Monday, and in a two-day trading period, the market lost almost a third of its value. If you had, for whatever reason, called up your advisor, your broker, whoever, and said, okay, sell my stock mutual fund, my large-cap stock mutual fund, and say it was 10 o'clock in the morning, well, he could put the trade through to do it and actually put the order in. But it won't go through till after 4 o'clock. But what happened over the course of that 6 hours is the value of that account could have dropped dramatically, and there's nothing the advisor could have done.
Because remember, it's the value of the underlying holdings. It's the holdings in the fund. So as their price dropped, that's what affects the net asset value of the mutual fund.
Now, you mentioned, let's say the same thing happened, and I have an ETF that marches a large-cap growth market.
You want to sell at noon? Sell at noon.
Well, you could actually get a confirmation of at what price your shares sold at while you're waiting on the telephone.
The other thing that you can do is you can set a stop loss if you wanted to. You could say, if the price drops below a certain price, I want to sell. So there's other, you know, possibilities.
Or you could target something to buy at a certain price on the upside.
Same way. They trade differently.
But so, like I said, it's a question of who you are, what you want to be as an investor. But the amount of effort that goes into making money within the portfolio you own will have something to do with what it actually costs to operate and run that fund. Mutual funds that have front-end sales charges, or what we affectionately call loads, that you may have heard about, and there are a number. Most of the mutual fund families in the market, when I came into the business, that's how they all were. That's how they did business. And the sales charge, or the load you're talking about, was the compensation, was the marketing cost, quite frankly, for the mutual fund company to sell their product to the investment marketplace, to consumers like you.
Remember, consumers didn't go directly to mutual fund companies in that time. They all went through advisors.
Yeah, so the broker / advisor, the mutual fund made it possible for the average investor out there who may not have hundreds of thousands of dollars, but for a relatively smaller amount, you could buy a basket of holdings that represented a piece of that same market. So that was all very, very important. Folks, we're talking about different aspects in the cost structure between active managers, indexes, and ETFs, but we're going to talk about the costs that are not related to the selling or buying of the fund share, but in fact, the cost of managing it internally and how that affects you. We'll be right back with more Money Talk Get Back to Basics. Stick around.
It's time for Dunkin' Donuts Regional Traffic, brought to you by Dunkin' Donuts.
Each other. They still do. The few. The proud. The Marines.
This is Money Talk with Don Sowa, exclusively on AM 790 Talk and Business.
And we are back with the Money Talk program. I'm Don Sowa with Donna Sowa Allard here in studio. Talking about pricing structure with mutual funds, we mentioned obviously there are active managed funds out there. There are index funds which simply match a specific index, like say the 500 largest companies in the U.S. That would be the S&P 500 fund. There is a mid-cap fund, which are mid-sized companies, say in the $5 to $10 billion range. That would be 400 companies that fall into that category. Another well-known fund is the Russell 2000 Index. which has 2,000 small companies, which could be anywhere from $500 million up to about $2 billion in size. It depends on a number of different things. Now, Donna, there are certainly, I would expect if you have a fund company, whether it's a Schwab or Fidelity or Vanguard, putting together an index fund, and they're basically using a algorithm, in other words, a computer model to do so, then perhaps the cost of the salary for the computer programmer is one thing. But a lot of this basic information is being provided, so it's going to be a very low-cost endeavor.
They're generally running screens, and the filters choose the companies for them based on the criteria that's input.
So the fund family, aside from the selling of the product to the public, getting it out into the public arena, that's really would be their primary cost.
There are still issues of execution and stuff like that, but it's not the same as having an active management team picking and choosing, researching, picking and choosing companies.
Now, there are categories of the market, however, such as emerging markets, companies that may deal with the Asia-Pacific market, people with Latin America, companies that are areas that are not what we call...
That require more management research and picking companies,
well,
right?
Well, there are... The U.S. market is essentially, as it was told to me, the only market where legally they mandate what they call GAAP principles.
And that's the GAAP, generally... accepted accounting principles.
Now, Europe, there are areas where they don't mandate it that way. However, the European markets tend to follow the accounting principles because they want their local companies that make up what would make up a European index. They know that the major U.S. companies, which are the major companies in the world, for the sales and distribution of their company shares, they're going to require them to offer a set of books that follow the GAAP accounting principles. Now, that's not necessarily true in other areas of the emerging markets world, like Asia-Pacific markets, sometimes the Chinese areas.
Some think of where they tend to play by their own rules.
And there could be two or three sets of books. So in a case like that, as one manager would say to me, we want to have analysts and researchers, boots on the ground, shall we say, literally kicking the tires of these companies.
And so you'll see the added cost of that requires, the added cost of management reflected in the internal expenses of the fund. You'll often see that those types of funds will have higher internal expenses. But some areas where there really is, where you're seeing this whole price war, which you referenced in the article at the beginning of the show, is, you know, like you said, the S&P 500 index, those large cap funds. And really last year, I remember sitting at a meeting with, at that time, the company was BlackRock that we were sitting down with, but they had come with the lowest price. I think theirs was an ETF as opposed to a mutual fund, but it was around like 8 basis points or something. Now we're seeing the mutual funds for those indexes coming in super, super low, super, super competitive between Schwab, Vanguard, and Fidelity. They've all got really, really low S&P 500 index funds. And the one you referenced right now, the lowest is Schwab at 3 basis points. So to put that in perspective for you, for every $100 dollars that goes in, it's 30 cents.
Yeah, one basis point, 100 basis points is 1%.
So that'd be a dollar.
Yeah, so it's pretty, they're very, very low costs, and that's reflective of the fact that the companies that get down to that level, by my best estimate, is they're using their S&P 500 index. Now, this is only on their S&P 500 index.
This is a loss leader.
It's a loss leader.
They know that's not what it actually costs to run the fund. It costs much more money than that. This is a loss leader for them to entice you in, which is why cost is something that you should be paying attention to when you're putting your portfolio together, but it should not be the only thing that you're paying attention to when choosing your investments.
Since the core positions in a great many broad-based portfolios are going to be in the large cap category, large cap value, which is companies that tend to be lower cost. In other words, the share price in the trading market may be 10 or 20% below book value. But in order to determine that, you're going to want to actually have somebody calculate the book value of the company. But these are publicly traded companies, and this is public information. So it's not difficult or expensive to acquire that information. A lot of it is available right on your laptop computer or your handheld device. But the core is sort of the center of your portfolio, and then you build off of that. So your core can be as the least expensive part of your plan. But one of the things that's important about these costs, if you get a prospectus for the mutual fund that you're investing in, the first couple of pages might be glossy. Well, that's pretty much put together by the marketing department. But when you get to the actual paper pages, the first paper page...
super thinner than newspaper.
It looks
paper.
Like a glossary, but when you look down at it, it's literally they're listing by SEC regulation all of the costs that are internal within that. And at the very bottom of the page, it'll say total expense ratio. And that's what it actually costs to operate the fund. So if the fund, to get you, well, simplicity, to get you 10% return, a mutual fund whose internal expenses are, say, 1%, and depending upon the type of fund it is, there are funds out there today that are going to have internal expenses of 1%. They have to earn a gross return of 11% to get you the 10% that you're being quoted. Now, the good news for you as an investor is that that investment advisors like ourselves and, quite frankly, periodicals that list information, including performance information for mutual funds and other companies, are required by law to list only only net performance. So that if I tell you, last year this particular fund did 8% return, well, that's what you would earn if you had owned it for the year last year. If they had to earn 8.5 because the internal expenses were 50 basis points, well, that's covering the internal expenses. But that doesn't matter. It's what you earned that matters. Now, this price war we're talking about on these internal expenses are, in fact, dealing with the S&P 500. And the reason that it is because it is the most popular specific fund offered in the investment market. It's a core holding for almost anyone. It seems like every mutual fund family has an S&P 500 fund of some sort, or they use it as their benchmark to compare other funds to.
Yeah. So, again, you want to be paying attention to your internal expenses, but just having the cheapest one doesn't mean you have the best one overall. Just having the fund family that has the cheapest doesn't mean you're going to get the best selection for the rest of your portfolio. So consider it, but don't make your decisions based solely on it.
So this was a current article showing the expense war between the three primary companies, Schwab, Fidelity, and Vanguard. The reason it matters here is that the performance of the underlying investments can hardly be different one from another. So if there is a difference in terms of what you make as an investor, it'll be because your internal expenses were lower. But in this case here, I think when it gets down to 1, 2, or 3 basis points, I'm not really sure it's going to matter that much.
Nope.
Well, anyway, folks, these are some of the differences. I realize some of it can seem complex, but we want you to be aware that there are differences from one fund to another. And sometimes, as the regulators recently stated, sometimes the lowest cost or the cheapest fund may not always be the best fund. But we'll find out. When you do research, that's the way you go with it. This has been Money Talk on Get Back to Basics Tuesday with Donna Soa Allard and myself, Don Soa. And we'll be back shortly tomorrow. Steve Bovee will be joining you at 5 o'clock with more Money Talk.